Hi, you're with Truth News Radio Australia on the 21st of January 2017. Welcome aboard on this second day of the epoch of Trump. And the world is already changing as a result of the inauguration of Donald Trump. Some interesting news fresh in. I have an article from climatedepot.com. All references to climate change have been deleted from the White House website. At 11:59 a.m. Eastern, the official White House website had a lengthy information page about the threat of climate change and the steps the federal government had taken to fight it. At noon, at the instant Donald Trump took office, the page was gone, as well as any mention of climate change or global warming. So this will please many people. Indeed, it certainly pleases me, but it will enrage the left, and it indicates that Donald Trump is holding true to so much of what he has promised about bringing change, real change, not the kind of fake change that was just a rhetorical technique that Barack Obama used for 8 years. Yesterday, as I was watching the live news streams, they were playing some of the inaugural speeches of previous presidents, and I listened to some of the inaugural speech of Barack Obama. And what really struck me about it was the completely abstract way in which Obama talks. He talks very well. He's very well trained. He's an orator. There's no doubt about that. But when Barack Obama gives speeches, it's almost as if you're being hypnotized. And actually, many people had indicated years ago that it appeared that Barack Obama was using NLP. And it seems most likely that he had been heavily trained in neuro-linguistic programming and just techniques, purely psychological techniques, to mesmerize an audience, to make them think that they were hearing something very important. Whereas, in fact, if you analyze what's actually being said, there's very little that's being said at all. It's just hope and change and wonderful feelings and cadences in the voice, you know, changing pace, building and then reaching a crescendo and then trailing off, and all this oratorical style. Compare that to Donald Trump's speech yesterday, where, yes, he does have some oratorial skills as well, but it's more straight up. It's certainly not as polished as Obama, but it has the impact of telling you that he's actually going to take action, and that the difference is that it's quite stark, actually, when you compare the two. The difference is that with Trump, he's talking about actually taking concrete actions. Even, you know, where he says he's going to transfer power from the government to the people. This is something that no other president has ever said, because it is a break from the sort of style of the elitist style of keeping the audience in the position of being kind of almost worshipful of the leader, and the leader somehow granting them wonderful beneficence just by speaking to them. Whereas what Trump's saying, no, that's over. He's saying, yeah, this is about you getting your power back, and I'm only here because of you. It's a very, very different change in angle. And then he talks specifically about real issues that are going on in the world, which again is something that Obama's great speeches always seem to just kind of wrap in a soft cotton wool gauze, so it was never really clear what he was talking about. But with Trump, he's very specifically talking about the way in which the economy has been ravaged by globalism, and he's saying that he's going to reverse that trend, and he's going to bring those jobs back that have been exported overseas. And he's very concrete and very direct about it. Now, I just want to, later on the show, I've got some very important stuff to talk about, but I want to just recap a little on my relationship with Donald Trump. Because I've been following Donald Trump very carefully since about January of 2016, and I was aware from that point that he was a very significant person and that his candidacy was unique. It didn't seem likely that he would win the election. It certainly didn't even seem likely he would win the nomination. But I could see that the policies that he was talking about were extremely important, and I did a number of podcasts on this. The first one I did was in April, and that was titled Trump versus Sanders, Who is the Bigger Threat to the Establishment? Now, I'll just read to you a little bit from the notes for that show, where I went through some of the key policy positions that Trump had articulated. And these still hold true. He hasn't really shifted in any of this. Ending toxic free trade, i.e. globalism. Reforming the US-China trade relationship. And by reforming, that means no longer allowing China to dictate to the US through currency manipulation how American manufacturing and trade works. He wants to change it in a way that America takes the power back. Reducing the US commitment to NATO. Withdrawing from the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Ending the Common Core curriculum. This is a teaching curriculum for mathematics, which is held in great disgust by many people around the world, particularly in America. It's an American program, but it appears to undermine some of the very important mechanisms of learning that have been traditionally used for time immemorial in terms of the way children learn mathematics. So very important that he's addressed this problem with Common Core curriculum, which appears to be one of these programs that has a slightly covert agenda, because it actually seems to undermine cognitive ability. Anyway, it's probably a subject for a whole show on its own, and I haven't really talked about it before, but if you're not aware of it, definitely look into Common Core curriculum on Google and you'll come up with a lot of interesting stuff. Okay, he wants to reduce illegal immigration. And of course, the focus there is illegal immigration. Trump has never said he wants to change immigration laws other than specifically about immigrants from countries where there is a history of terrorism. He wants to work with ISIS. Sorry, he wants to work against ISIS with Russia. He wants to work with Russia to destroy ISIS. He wants to open up a discussion of vaccine safety. And that he's certainly held true on that after appointing Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to a special commission. And Robert Kennedy Jr. is, of course, a well-known critic of vaccines. And this new commission that Trump has appointed is going to be specifically looking at those issues. He wants to legitimize skepticism on climate change. And as I said there at the beginning of the show, already we see climate change completely removed from the White House as an issue. This is going to have an incredibly strong effect. This is going to have a ripple effect right around the world, and it's going to last a long time. It's going to change the whole direction of civilization on this planet, I dare say. Significant healthcare reforms, and Trump has already signed the initial executive orders cancelling provisions of Obamacare. A non-interventionist foreign policy. Well, everything that he's said up till now has indicated that he's holding true with that. He does have some views and some positions which some people may consider to be worrisome, for example, his strong support of Israel. But at this point in time, The only thing that he's concretely said in relation to Israel is that he's considering moving the US embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. And of course, the media has had a field day with this, and they've gone crazy over it, saying, you know, it proves that that Trump is against the peace process, and that you know, the Palestinians will be up in arms and all these terrible things. Whereas, in fact, this is purely symbolic. I mean, moving the embassy from Tel Aviv to East Jerusalem would have no impact on territorial claims, and it should really just be an administrative decision on the part of the US government as to where it wants to have its embassy. Of course, if it positioned the embassy in West Jerusalem, that would be a little different, but there's no indication that that's going to happen, and it would be highly unlikely they would do that, because it's obviously not going to be as safe or stable a place. And the most important thing for a US embassy is to put it in a place where it is safe and stable. So clearly they're not going to put it in West Jerusalem. So this is a big symbolic act that or statement even that Trump has made, which really says nothing about what he's really going to do. What we need to see is what specific steps he's going to take in terms of Israel's land acquisitions, and what he's going to say about that, and the building of settlements, and whether he's actually going to try and bring members of Palestinian groups to the table for a discussion. And of course, bear in mind, the current government of Israel is on the way out. Bibi Netanyahu is in a very, very weak position. He's very much a lame duck prime minister at present, and it's quite likely that he will be replaced within the next year or two by a much more moderate centrist type government, which is not going to follow some of these extreme Zionist policies of Netanyahu. And this, I believe, is more along the lines of what Trump will try and pursue, and it'll be about getting some kind of dialogue happening again. And I'm almost certain that that's what's going to happen. And then as we go forward, you'll see that actually, yes, Trump will be the guy who gets the two sides talking together again, because he's pragmatic, and because he's not tied down to globalist geopolitical forces. And it's obviously in everyone's best interest, in the world's best interest, that the Palestinians and Israel come to an agreement and develop some kind of mutual coexistence. That has to be seen as a clearly rational objective. It's only not seen as that by people who are trying to foment war and conflict. And these are some of the people that Trump is actually up against, that he's in direct conflict with within the deep state of the US, which is why he's been under such pressure and been undermined to such a degree from the intelligence community, who are tied to this deep state agenda. Okay, we're going to break. Anyway, those are just a few comments there about some of those policy positions, which I believe haven't changed. And more on this topic when we come back from break. You're with Truth News Radio. It's great to be with you today. Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. And I was just before the break there talking about one of the podcasts I did earlier in the year on the 5th of April. Actually, no, it was broadcast on the 2nd of April 2016. And the title of that podcast was Trump versus Sanders, Who is the Bigger Threat to the Establishment? Now, I noticed at that time, and it's fairly early on in the campaign, that Trump's positions were much more anti-establishment, were much more radical in good ways than the stuff that Bernie Sanders was saying. And I sensed at that time that there was something not quite genuine about Bernie Sanders. I just had a very strong gut feeling, which was proven to be totally correct, that Bernie Sanders was a front man. And he certainly proved himself to be purely, I mean, maybe not purely, but very, very largely a front man for Hillary Clinton. And, you know, he espoused a lot of ideas that many, many millennials gravitated towards. But so many of these ideas are kind of the phony ideas of socialism, which have so many deep flaws that have already been pointed out, has already been analysed so well. And I think it's interesting that Bernie Sanders' pull was mainly with younger people. And I think that's an indication of the fact that you've got to have a high degree of naivety to buy in to these socialist memes. And along with the socialist memes, there's also the cultural Marxism, which, again, it appeals to an immature state of mind. It appeals to people who haven't really matured either emotionally or intellectually, I have to say, because it's pretty much a childlike kind of perspective on the world. You know, some people are good, some people are bad, and, you know, these people say naughty things, and so, you know, they're the bad people, you know, and it doesn't matter about anything else. You know, if someone is sexist, or, you know, says something that someone calls misogynist, or says something that someone says is homophobic, then it's like, you know, you you've had the label put on you, and, you know, you've sort of been branded. Like, it's like children in a kindergarten. This is actually the mentality of political correctness. Now, just reading here from the same podcast I did, I wrote as part of the write-up to this podcast, criticisms of Trump generally involve a mixture of the following claims: that he's politically incorrect, that he's sexist, that he's against same-sex marriage, that he's xenophobic, that he's racist, that he's overly aggressive. And notice how all of the above criticisms derive from the dominant left ideology, which sees the entire world through the lens of class warfare at the level of culture. This way of looking at the world, which perfectly sums up supporters of Bernie Sanders, largely ignores the problems of globalism because it is tied to a radically statist program wherein every social ill will be ironed out by intervention, regulation, taxes, and taxpayer-funded free services. Sanders unashamedly endorses this political philosophy and highlights the following policy positions: eliminating tax deductions for corporations, eliminate wealth inequality, free education, universal health care, women's rights, LGBT rights, immigrants' rights, climate change action. And I wrote, when you look honestly at the full scope of Sanders versus Trump, it becomes clear that Sanders is speaking from the position of the establishment, even though he claims otherwise, whereas Trump is a disruptive force threatening the power and supremacy of his own class. Indeed, anyone who has looked at politics honestly can see the left establishment and the right establishment are but two wings of the same entity, and neither intends to do anything to end globalism, which is destroying Western civilization. And so important to note that, as I said here, he's threatening the power and supremacy of his own class. And this is the class of very rich people, an elite class of people who own all of the large businesses, all of the banks. They own everything, folks. And for one of their own to come forth as a champion of the people is so rare. Like, it's the sort of thing that maybe only happens once every 100 or 500 years. I mean, it's very, very rare. Because a person who does that is willing to make the greatest sacrifice. It's highly likely that an individual who does this will actually be killed off, because the elite protect themselves at all costs, and when one of their own turns against them, they will certainly take that individual out. And you know, we've seen that happen. We've certainly seen that happen. I mean, we saw it happen with Kennedy. It's happened, I believe. Diana Spencer, indeed, was another example of that. She was a member of the ruling elite through marriage, and her positions and what she was doing was extremely threatening, and they were quite willing to take her out. Always done in a way that they can either make it look like an accident or make it look like a rogue lone gunman or whatever. But they will ensure, they will try to protect themselves at all costs. And another individual who was removed, and this is actually a topic of a podcast I did on the 7th of May 2016, was William McKinley. Now, the title of that podcast was Trump and McKinley, Kindred Spirits 100 Years Apart. And here's a quote here from the notes to that show. It turns out that the last president elected on a policy of raising trade tariffs was William McKinley, who was assassinated on September 6th, 1901. One of the most troubling aspects of the official narrative of McKinley's assassination is its parallel to the assassination of the two Kennedy brothers. The shots were fired by a lone gunman with no clear motive other than McKinley was seen as a symbol of oppression, and despite the fact that powerful interest groups stood to benefit greatly by his demise. The convicted perpetrator, Leon Czolgosz, was portrayed as an anarchist, a term which was meant to symbolize irrational hatred and violence in a manner that is strangely familiar in this age of terrorism. Now, of course, the raising of trade tariffs is really probably the central policy of Donald Trump. It is the most challenging one, it's the most radical one, and it's the one that actually made me really take him seriously. And this policy of raising trade tariffs was indeed a policy that was it was in play in the 19th century to some degree, and then when William McKinley was elected, it became a very prominent part of McKinley's policies, and it was one of the major ways of raising taxes. Remember, before 1913, there was no income tax, and trade tariffs were the main way in which tax was raised for the government. And just returning here to my own notes, there are two key aspects to McKinley's policies which were a thorn in the side of burgeoning globalist forces at that time. One was his strong support of the gold standard, and the second was his support of import tariffs. Both of these policies created powerful sources of revenue for the government, which were completely outside the control of banks. In his last speech, McKinley urged reciprocity treaties with other nations to assure American manufacturers access to foreign markets. He intended the speech to be a keynote to his plans for a second term. We're just going to break. We're talking about some earlier podcasts I did in relation to Donald Trump. We'll be right back. Stay with us. We'll be right back. welcome back. And I'll just continue here reading from my notes on the podcast I did of the relationship between William McKinley and Donald Trump. William McKinley, President of the United States, who was assassinated in 1901. At the time of McKinley's presidency, there was no federally mandated income tax. The government had all the money it needed from tariffs and gold reserves, which were getting larger as a result of extensive gold mining activities. With the wisdom of hindsight, it is not hard to see why the financial oligarchy wanted to eliminate McKinley, to open the way for the creation of central banking and the use of income tax as a method of social control, and to begin the process of subverting the sovereignty of the United States. So have a look at that podcast if you didn't catch it earlier, because I do go into some more details there, and it's certainly a very interesting parallel. And when I did the research on that, I was honestly very concerned that Trump may not make it. Of course, it didn't even seem likely he would make it to the nomination at that point. Of course, there are still a lot of concerns, but I think his position is a lot stronger now. And I think even if he were assassinated now, I think it would be very difficult to stop the changes he's put in place. A very important reason for that is that his vice president, Mike Pence, is totally together with Trump. There is no rift between the vice president and the president, as we saw, for example, with Kennedy and Johnson. And looking back on it, I would say that the Kennedy's appointment of LBJ as his vice president actually set him up for an assassination, because Johnson was completely opposed to Kennedy in so many ways. He was a very different type of person. He came from a different class to Kennedy. They had no affinity with each other. Johnson was extremely jealous and envious of Kennedy's power and prestige. Johnson really wanted to be president. This has all been documented, and it was all put in Roger Stone's book on LBJ, which there's information about that on my show as well. If you Google LBJ Roger Stone, it's an interview that I did back in about 2014. But what's clear is that Johnson was at least heavily involved in the plot against Kennedy, if not one of the major masterminds of it. And this problem was created in a way by Kennedy's appointment of LBJ, but which he felt he had to do in order to win the election, in order to get the support from different parts of the establishment. And he was able to do that by using Johnson. But in the end, that was what brought him down. But with Trump, we have a situation where there would be no discontinuity in policy if Trump were to go. The key policy positions of Trump would be held, and in some ways, the more extreme versions of that would be pushed by Mike Pence. So I don't think that an assassination of Trump at this stage is actually going to work as a strategy. I think it may have worked if it had happened before the election, even right up until the inauguration. And of course, there'd been some talk of, you know, maybe they're going to take out the whole lot of them there at the Capitol building. But of course, that didn't happen. And so we're past that. And I think we're past worrying about that as an issue. Of course, it could still happen. Anything could happen. But the key changes now have been put in place, and, you know, nothing can stop an idea whose time has come. And ideas are bulletproof. So the time has come, the ideas have come to fruition, and now we're going to see the unfolding of that. There's going to be a lot of change. Meanwhile, the regressive forces, the forces of globalism and outdated, anachronistic political concepts like collectivism and socialism are still going to have a last dying gasp. And I want to actually address one aspect of that, which is getting a lot of attention at the moment and was actually the subject of a special presentation at the Davos Economic Forum. And it is one which I think we really need to be aware of, and you need to realize how insidious it is, and we need to educate people about its extreme danger, its extreme toxicity. And this is about an idea that's been floated in many different countries about what they're calling a basic income. Now, I've got an article here which was posted on the World Economic Forum website, weforum.org, and the title of that article is Why We Should All Have a Basic Income. Now, this is an idea which is so totally against the grain of the changes that Donald Trump signifies, that it represents the exact opposite of the positive change that we see coming. And it is about a regressive, a feudalistic, totalitarian, socialist, oligarchical approach to managing society. It's really, really scary. But, you know, thank heavens we have an alternative agenda now. We have something else on the surface of this earth that is working in a very, very different direction. But let me read to you from this article, written by Scott Suntens, and it was published on the 15th of January, 2017. Consider for a moment that from this day forward, on the first day of every month, around $1,000 is deposited into your bank account because you are a citizen. This income is independent of every other source of income and guarantees you a monthly starting salary above the poverty line for the rest of your life. What do you do? Possibly of more importance, what don't you do? How does this firm foundation of economic security and positive freedom affect your present and future decisions, from the work you choose to the relationships you maintain to the risks you take? The idea is called unconditional or universal basic income, or UBI. It's like social security for all, and it's taking root within minds around the world and across the entire political spectrum for a multitude of converging reasons. Rising inequality, decades of stagnant wages, the transformation of lifelong careers into sub-hourly tasks, exponentially advancing technology like robots and deep neural networks, increasingly capable of replacing potentially half of all human labour, world-changing events like Brexit, and the election of Donald Trump. All of these and more are pointing to the need to start permanently guaranteeing everyone at least some income. Now, when we come back from the break, I want to play to you a video clip which is filmed actually at the World Economic Forum where this idea is being discussed. Let me just briefly break down to you the major glaring problems with this, right? First one being, as soon as you start giving money to everyone, like everyone, that then becomes a new base standard, right? It's exactly like when a home loan grant is issued to everyone and it actually causes the price of all property to go up. By giving $1,000 a month to everybody, it will have an inflationary effect. And of course it will be taken into account by employers who know that the person they're hiring is getting an extra $1,000 a month. We're just going to break. Stay with us. You're with Truth News Radio Australia.
What happens in terms of creating wars is a mind manipulation technique called problem reaction solution. And it works like this. And it works like this. First of all, you create the problem, but you get someone else to be blamed for it. You then report that problem through the media in the way you want it reported. You get the public to react to your problem by saying something must be done, this can't go on, what are they going to do about it?
Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. And I'm just discussing the issues here with this concept of universal basic income. And the first problem clearly is that this inflationary aspect. As soon as you just pump money into the economy like that, it has an instant inflationary effect. It's very hard to predict how that will go. And it could just result in the price of everything going up, which means it will have no net value at all. But it will have a lot more negative effects. And one of the negative effects, of course, could be that it could result in a lowering of wages because employers will simply take into account that, you know, you're getting $1,000 a month, so I can actually pay you a little less. I mean, of course, it will be a help to those who are without work. Those are at the lowest rung of society who earn very little or nothing. They, of course, will appreciate it. But remember, they already have a leg up. They already have all kinds of programs to help them in Western countries. So it won't actually make that much difference to them. But, of course, those people won't certainly be against it. It'll make their lives a little easier that they won't have to constantly justify why they couldn't get a job. You know, it'll take that pressure off them. But, of course, for those who do have a job, it will most likely have a negative impact. I mean, it will have a massively negative impact on the entire middle class of people who work hard. And that just seems like a fairly conservative prediction based on inevitable facts about how the economy works. But let me play to you the video here from the World Economic Forum, and we'll just play a few minutes of it, and I'll interrupt to give a few of my thoughts. Davos 2017, A Basic Income for All, Dream or Delusion. Here we go.
Greetings all. My name is Tamsin. I'm your moderator for this session. Welcome to everyone. The session is A Basic Income for All, Dream or Delusion. So if I can just frame the subject a tiny bit, the background is that paid work is becoming a less generous, or seems to be becoming a less generous and less reliable source of income for many people, which means that a very old and, I think, extraordinarily radical idea has come to the fore, the notion of an unconditional government payment to all citizens, either as a supplement to or a replacement for paid for working income. So it's really happening. It's not just a theory. So Switzerland said no to it last year, but there are plenty of other places which are beginning experiments. So Finland just began. The Canadian province of Ontario is going to have an experiment. Cities in Scotland, four Dutch cities. And to discuss the pros and cons of the idea, we have four panelists here with me who are extraordinarily well qualified to comment. To my left is Professor Guy Standing of the University of London, who is the co-president of the Basic Income Earth Network, or BIEN, which he co-founded actually in 1986, which gives some clue as to the age of the idea. We have Professor Michael Sandel, who's professor of government at Harvard University and author of What Money Can't Buy, The Moral Limits of Markets. We have Ms. Nelly Kroes, who's been a prominent Dutch politician, was EU Commissioner for Competition, most recently for the Digital Agenda for Europe. and now sits on several corporate boards, including Uber and Salesforce. And we have Amitabh Kant, who's the CEO of the main think tank of the Indian government, Niti Aayog. And it's just been reported that the Indian government is looking very seriously at universal basic income as well. So this, in the first 15 minutes or so, I'm just going to ask each of our panelists to offer all of their thoughts, really, on the question of as work changes, as work is changing, is a universal basic income really a solution to this problem? First, Guy.
Well, thank you very much, and welcome to everybody. Thanks for coming to this session. When you've been working on a subject for 30 years and you're suddenly told you have 4 to 5 minutes to give your perspective, you feel a slight sense of awe. And I want to begin actually by a little poem from Barbara Wootton, who said, "It's from the champions of the impossible rather than the slaves of the possible that evolution draws its creative force." And I use that in our 25th anniversary because we've been going through a period where we've been doing a lot of fundamental research on the feasibility, affordability, implications of a basic income, and for many years, totally ignored. But in the last couple of years, there's suddenly been a huge surge of interest, partly by a realization about automation. Now, I want to stress that that is not my rationale for a basic income. It never has been. But it's quite useful because it's made us much more topical. The reason I found that I always fought for a basic income are threefold. First, it's a means of social justice. This goes back to Thomas Paine and Henry George and people who said public wealth is created over generations. And any of us know, or should know, and have the humility to know, that our income and wealth is fundamentally due to the contributions of previous generations, and much more than anything you or I do ourselves. And therefore, if you allow private inheritance, we should also have public inheritance as a social dividend on public wealth created. That means of social justice is fundamental behind why I believe in a basic income. The second reason is that it is a means to enhance republican freedom. Republican freedom is different from standard liberal forms of freedom in the sense that it means freedom from domination by figures of authority using their arbitrary power. It is a mechanism for enhancing republican freedom. And the third reason is that it is a means of providing people with basic security. Basic security. And in that regard, we claim, those of us who support basic income, it is not for eradicating poverty per se. It is for handling the issue of insecurity.
I'm just going to have to leave it there because we don't have much time. I'll put that up on the website. I just want to address those three points that he raised there, because I think there's a lot of fallacies in what he's saying. This idea of a public inheritance. Now, he was saying that if we allow to have private inheritance, we should therefore have a concept of public inheritance. But what that actually means is he's basically talking about a collectivist collectivist idea that the society as a whole is to be regarded and treated as an organic unit. And this always has a kind of a counterbalancing relationship to the individual. And wherever you see that argument being used about the people as a whole being entitled to something, you can guarantee that there's a price to be paid for the individual. See, where the collective gains, the individual must lose. Now, the second idea he raised, which is what he called republican freedom, this seems incredibly dubious to me, and I mean, that's just his interpretation of the way that it would play out. But it actually, to me, raises more questions than it answers, because in any implementation of a system like this, if you think that the money is just going to be given out with absolutely no strings attached, I mean, that is a radically naive, ridiculous expectation. Because the government, no government in history ever, has ever given anything out with no strings attached. And we've seen in recent years, and very recently, that the government is moving towards actually tying benefits to your performance and behaviour. And I cite, for example, the No Jab, No Pay legislation, which went through Australia's parliament just last year, which prevents you from getting a very standard tax break, which is supposed to be universal. It's universal in the same sense that this proposed basic income would be universal for people who have families, right? It's a standard tax deduction. And the government decided, in its wisdom, for the greater good, that if you don't get all the shots for your kids, if you miss even one injection, then you're not entitled to that universal benefit, right? So that's just an example, and it's just so clear, it's so obvious that this is the type of direction that those who administer policies like this will take. And it is part of the creation of a type of a caste system. Because those who are very wealthy, those who are way, way high up the chain, won't be affected by any of this. But those who are working hard, who are in the middle class, will be most affected by it. Those who are right down the bottom won't be affected by it much either. But this will actually have the effect of reducing the wealth of the middle class. And yeah, there are a lot more reasons for that, which I just don't have time to get into. But as I was saying, that there'll be this pressure. Well, there'll be this pressure on employers, you know, to see if they can economise by lowering wages, considering that everyone gets a universal income. There's a critique of it up on the ABC, which I'll put a link to, which illustrates some of those points. Anyway, it's a topic I'm going to cover in more detail in future podcasts. I do hope you've enjoyed the show today, and welcome to the era of Trump, and I'm looking forward to a very interesting year coming up. Truth News Radio Australia, signing off. See you next week.